board members, and welcome to the committee meeting. What we're going to be doing today is looking at an environmental review that was done by the EPA. And we're looking at it not for the actual outcome or the science of the worksheet. We're looking at it for the process, and we're looking at it for how the public was engaged or not engaged during the whole process. So those are the two things that are on, certainly were on my mind when I scheduled this meeting. There's been lots of discussion in the public about EISs and EAWs, and I think the best thing that we can do is start by having our own attorney talk to us about what the law says. And you will note that in your packet is there are copies of the current law, which I don't think has changed for a long time, but we can ask our own attorney about that. You will see also that the plant in discussion here actually never went forward, and so that's why this is probably a particularly good case study, since we're not looking at something that is active right now. And the third thing you will see is from the Pollution Control Agency is the number of hours and the folks that worked on this EAW. So those are the things in your packet. And with that, Ms. Taylor, if you could help us out by going over the law for us.
Sure, Madam Chair and members, the Chair asked me to kind of review existing statute and rules to see what the environmental assessment worksheet process should be according to the statute and rules. And as she said, you should all have a copy of the statute in your packets. And I'm just going to start with the definition of an environmental assessment worksheet in statute. And it just states that it's a brief document which is designed to set out the basic facts necessary to determine whether an environmental impact statement is required for a proposed action. And then it is further clarified in Minnesota Rules, Part 4410.1000. Excuse me, I have one of those calls that's going around. And in Rules, it says it's a brief document prepared in worksheet format, which is designed to rapidly assess the environmental effects which may be associated with a proposed project. The EAW serves primarily to aid in the determination of whether an EIS is needed for a proposed project, and B, serve as a basis to begin the scoping process for an EIS. Now, in statute, the UCB was charged with developing the form and content of an environmental assessment worksheet, which they did. And what they came up with was eight major categories for an environmental assessment worksheet. The first couple were pretty basic, the project name, the proposer, and the location, and then also the contact person and some procedural issues. The other categories included a description of the project, the purpose for the project, the methods of construction, quantification of the physical characteristics and the impacts, description of the project site, and land use and physical features of the surrounding area. It also requires some resource protection measures that have been incorporated into the project to be identified, any potential environmental impacts and issues that may require further investigation, then any known governmental approvals, reviews, or financing that may apply, an assessment of the compatibility of the project with any approved plans of local units of government, and then if the project is going to be done by a government unit, a brief explanation of the need for the project and an identification of those who will benefit from the project. May, the UCB did develop an actual worksheet, which is available online if anybody was interested. It's an 8-page document, and there's about 30 questions to be completed by the responsible government unit. In statute, the UCB was charged with coming up with mandatory categories or projects that would need an environmental assessment worksheet, and also those that would also need an environmental impact statement. There's also a petition, a submission of petition process that was established in statute, in which case 25 citizens could petition for an environmental assessment worksheet. This isn't available for environmental impact statements, but it is available for the worksheet. And it also must accompany evidence that there'll be the project does have the potential for significant environmental effects. And also in rule, the UCB itself or a government unit with authority over the project can request an EAW. There aren't any statutory or rule requirements for how long the process should take. But once the environmental assessment worksheet is completed, there is a public review period, a 30-day public comment period. And then after that is done, the responsible government unit has up to 30 days to finish or make a decision. And then once that, there is in statute a process for judicial review if necessary, so another 30 days. And then unlike the environmental impact statement, there is no fee or anything like that. So the costs are borne by the responsible government unit. That kind of concludes my comments on the environmental assessment worksheet. I can answer questions, but I'm sure we'll get into more detail when the other testifiers are here.
I'm sure we are going to have some questions later, but if there are questions now, we can take them.
If not, then Jeff Broberg, Paul Wazitska, and Jan Blevins, if you'd all come down at once, I think that would be helpful. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Broberg. I'm going to lead off our presentation today, and what I'd like to do is start out with a short statement about my involvement in the process in EAW. I'm going to turn it over to Jan Blevins, who's on my left, a local citizen, and then to Paul Wazitska to talk about this from a scientific and technical perspective, and then bring it back to me, and I'd like to make some observations and recommendations. To start out, maybe introduce myself. I'm a licensed professional geologist here in Minnesota. I was the 19th geologist certified. I worked on the original bill to get certification, and the importance of that is the professional duty that is incumbent upon licensed professionals in the state of Minnesota. Science is science, not advocacy, and that is the role that we have to play whenever we're engaged in any professional duty. I have 19 years of experience with MRLA, our statutes that relate to environmental review, and I've been engaged in almost every level of environmental review. And the thing that is probably the most striking in this is that it is almost always engaged in some level of conflict. These are review documents that are meant to change the landscape and to understand what the issues are that relate to permits and whether there's significant environmental effects. An important part of the process is the public review. And under MRLA, it says that the state requires early public involvement in the process. And that's something we're going to talk about has not happened in this particular case. We had to file FOIA requests. I don't think that was the statute's intention for public involvement.
Why don't you tell people what that was?
The FOIA request is Freedom of Information Act under data practices. But once we learned of this process well in advance, we had to file official filings with all of the state agencies in order to get information. And part of those requests were denied in the early days of this process, even though we had a right to this public information. I want to talk just real briefly about the roles that I've played in EAW processes because I take a different perspective depending on the role that I play. I have represented applicants. who are those individuals that are writing the documents so that they can be passed on to the regulating government unit, the RGU. I've played a role in that regard as a science advisor and technical person that's responsible for this. And just as important, the role of communicating technical information to the public so that they can understand it and the decision makers can use it. I've also played a role working for RGUs that are the ones responsible for administering the process. In my role as a representative, it's really about truth and consequences. You're required to understand and make sure that the applications are complete and correct, and the process is followed. I've also played a role as a citizen advocate on behalf of petitioners and even opponents to projects, where my role is to review and understand and try to disclose the problems. I want to delve into this a little more in detail, that as an applicant and as a consultant, the perspective that you take is you want things to go well for your client. You want this to be a fast process. You want it to be thorough, complete, no hitches in the get-along, and to move through in a fairly predictable fashion. And if you have issues that are of concern, you'd like not to make those big issues. So frankly, there's an exercise of misdirection that occurs, and oftentimes obfuscation. I shouldn't make this admission, perhaps, but it is what advocates for applicants do if there are environmental problems. You don't want those to become the headlines on the newspapers, so you're always working for ways to make sure that that doesn't happen. One of the things that happens is you try and develop a collegial relationship with the RGU. You want to be their buddies. No cross words with the people that are regulating this process. You want to make sure that it's yes, sir, and no, sir, and I'll get you the information as quick as we can, and that everything works smoothly. It's different representing an RGU. The RGU, regulating government unit, responsible for this, is driving the bus. I think that's a good analogy, because they set the route, the fares, who gets on, where they sit, who gets off, and who they drive over in the process. It's a different perspective in that you're looking for accuracy as an RGU, number one, completeness, and the process. But in all of my roles representing an RGU, it was never my job to do the applicant's work. It was never my role to impart the science. That was the applicant's responsibility, to come forward with all of the technical details in a manner that can be communicated adequately for the decision makers. In this instance, the MPCA has played that role as the RGU. They have that responsibility for things like feedlots and ethanol plants and some other small numbers of things that are usually more technical in detail. And the purpose for that designation is that you have technical people that are doing the technical work, and the public then relies on them to make sure that information is thorough and accurate and wants to have the ability to rely on that information. As a citizen and an advocate for people, I've been hired to file petitions, help people file petitions to require an EAW, or even as an opponent to the project to pick apart the details that are evident so that we can understand and decision makers have the information necessary to make good decisions. I want to make a full disclosure on the Minergy plant. I'm one of those opponents. I have been representing the Minnesota Trout Association due to my concern over groundwater resources and the impact of ethanol production in the karst landscape of southeastern Minnesota. And I've worked very hard to uncover some of the scientific problems that have occurred. And in this process, just briefly before I turn it over to Jan, we started in the fall of 2006 when we first had news reports of a pending or a proposed ethanol plant in the town of Yoda, which is shown on the picture behind you. I should have maybe introduced this. The plant site is on the far right, and the town of Yoda is kind of wrapped around the center or the area on the left. So that's the town of Yoda. The plant is less than a half a mile away. 75 million gallon a year plant, and we first filed a Freedom of Information Act request to the city and the county. And we're amazed to find a response from the city that said they couldn't discuss it because they had signed a confidentiality agreement with the applicant. So they refused to give us any information in their files. They said we're bound by this agreement that we made, which we felt was clearly inappropriate, and we thought we should dig deeper. We then made a Freedom of Information Act request in the winter of 2007 to the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources, and started to understand the scope of the project and the location and the issues that are related. And a primary concern to me as a professional geologist was the karst. This was an area that had sinkholes, groundwater drainage that we didn't understand, surface water drainage that was complicated. We followed this through the Freedom of Information Act process and found a lot of emails that were actually a weekly or biweekly meeting of the agency and phone conference with the applicant that had significant details about the process. We asked to be included on those emails and were denied. We got the recovery of the data and we found numerous emails that were marked confidential, not for public review. Those issues were easily resolved through the commissioner's office. These are all public documents. We had the right to review all of this information. But early on, it set up an adversarial relationship. We had a collegial group among the applicants and the Pollution Control Agency trying to keep all of their stuff from becoming controversial. And we had outsiders that were on the hunt for information that might be useful to our purposes. The process continued, and in February of 2008, we had had verbal communications back and forth with the Department of Natural Resources and MPCA over issues, and we had understood that there were some new reports related to my expertise on karst geology, and we filed a report for those and found it full of errors and omissions and misrepresentations about the risk of the karst and the sinkholes and the groundwater fall. And we were told that we were best served by making written response to those. It took hundreds of hours with a number of experts to put together a 37-page report identifying the errors and omissions in those reports. And it turned out that report was received by the MPCA days before the draft of the EAW was to go out on public notice. And what we found in reviewing that draft is they had no recognition of the errors. And even though the scientists and technical people at the PCA were responsible for checking for the completeness of the document, we found and felt that that job had not been done adequately. They did withdraw the draft of the EAW and told the applicant to go back and do more work. To date, now there's been 90 soil borings and cores on the site on approximately 90 acres, so that they can identify and engineer the solutions to that risk. We moved forward with this, and finally in May of 2008, the EAW was published for a 30-day public comment period. The earlier comments that we had issued, we had asked, actually implored, the agency to make this legible and understandable. Simple things, for instance. There were areas where in one paragraph they would use metric measures and English measures. It was so many meters from something and so many miles from something else that were incomprehensible to a normal citizen. It wasn't packaged in a way that was amenable to an understanding of citizens or local decision makers, and it created a lot of difficulty. We were successful in getting a delay. Instead of 30 days to review this dense technical document full of technical details that we knew had errors, and omissions. We were given an extended period of time to do that before it advanced to hearings at the Pollution Control Agency Board. In October, we made a presentation to the board, and we raised our issues, and at that time, they asked the staff to prepare findings to conduct an environmental impact statement on five specific issues that we had raised, and tabled that decision till the next month. We used a little bit of a technique, I guess, in that we didn't have the technical resources of the applicant. We built a cake that showed the geology and displayed in actually a scale-level detail of the risks that we were talking about with the karst and the groundwater flow and the interaction of streams and groundwater. It was well received, and they thought we felt like we had raised important issues, and we were asked to come back the next month, and the applicant had responded in a very fundamental effort, describing geology in cartoonist terms that, in my opinion as a geologist, obfuscated the risk that we were asking them to look at. And the PCA board, in the process, we never had the opportunity to rebut those comments. We never had the opportunity to raise the issues of concerns that we had, and they approved the EAW and granted the permits. Shortly after that, Energy announced that they no longer had the financing and have not gone forward. That's kind of a review of the process. I want to turn this over to Jan Blevins to talk about the perspective from citizens. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'd like to talk when Paul is done again.
But before you go on, I'm listening to our council. The EAW is supposed to be a brief document, and it's to according to the rules, rapidly assess. I'm not quite sure of the timeline here. What is the date that the application was made to the PCA to the time when the EIS was put out for comment, or the EAW was put out for comment, not the final comment?
The data that we had reviewed from our Freedom of Information Act request shows that this initial submittal to the agency had first engaged them in the winter of 2006.
The winter of 2006, and that was to then.
Now the draft of the first draft of the EAW was from the records that we have was in early 2007. Of the first draft that was submitted, and the PCA started their work of ostensibly reviewing this document. So it didn't get out into the public in its official form then until May of 2008.
June of 2008. So this is a year and a half?
Yes.
Roughly?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify the timeline here, because all right, thank you. Ms. Blevins, if you would like to go ahead.
Madam Chair, good morning. My name is Jan Blevins. I live at 1448 110th Avenue Southeast on a small farm that my family has owned since 1945 near Yoda. I'm one of those normal citizens. My background, and then presently I work with commercial businesses on saving energy, so it's dear to my heart. Approximately 2.5 years ago, I found a couple of surveyors at the end of my driveway and stopped to talk to them. After much discussion and perseverance, the surveyor finally told me that they were surveying because of a proposed ethanol refinery that was to be built near Yoda. They said this information was confidential and not to let anyone know that they had told me. That threw up a red flag. Why was this being kept secret unless there was something wrong with what was being done? Upon learning this, I invited about 40 neighbors that surround the location of the proposed ethanol refinery into my home to determine their feelings and thoughts on having this type of industry as a neighbor. When I found that my neighbors were also unaware of this proposed refinery, We determined we should organize and educate ourselves on what the impacts of an ethanol refinery would have on a community such as ours. We formed a group now known as OC3, or Olmsted County Concerned Citizens. I called the company that the surveyor had given me, named NRG. I spoke with a mark that stated he could not tell me anything because it was confidential. He did say that if we wanted to stop this, we'd better get going. Realizing that we needed help understanding what we were facing, we hired a geologist and brought others that had the technical expertise to explain what this would do to our small community. These people that assisted us are well known and respected in their field of expertise. We went to the township board and they decided to invite the MPC down to meet with us. The first MPC meeting held, we had good hopes. We felt perhaps we would get answers, but rather than let us ask questions, they told us we could not ask questions. We would have to write each question down on a 3x5 card and submit it. I know that I wrote down about 30 questions and submitted them, but to this day I've never received answers. With that atmosphere set at the first meeting, we determined that the MPCA was not going to help us, but had already determined that the ethanol refinery was going to be built in the older location. That is when we realized that the MPCA had been working with Minergy Investors for some time. We were very disillusioned because I thought the MPCA's charge was to protect the environment, not protect industry and provide information for them. Three other meetings were held. We felt that at the second and third meetings, the MPCA had not come prepared to answer our technical questions, and when we challenged their information, they became very defensive and stated time and time again that all questions would be answered in the EAW, or just stated that they could not answer. One meeting, they changed the order of the meeting, and since they did not let us know, we missed the time for questions. They did allow us to ask a few, but ran out of time. MPCA's actions fostered distrust in the process. They appeared that they had one agenda, and that was to support the investors. The citizens of Eota and Eota Township left these meetings frustrated with little hope that their concerns were being heard or considered. It is our feeling that the MPCA was more concerned about the needs and wants of the 32 investors that do not live in the area, and our needs or concerns were not important. They told us about a dead zone that would be created by the refinery, and when they found out that it was on another person's property, they denied they ever used that term. When we asked if they would build their homes next to this refinery, they said no. But when asked in front of the citizens' board, they claimed that the person that answered that question was not on their permanent staff, yet they introduced her as the air quality expert. When we found that the MPCA stated if a chain link fence was installed around the refinery, there would be no air pollution because the air would stay in the fenced area. We are not stupid, and we do not wish to be treated as such. During this process, we spoke with Brad Moore and asked to be a part of the MPCA Min Energy team and process. He stated that we would be invited. We never were. We invited the MPCA down to discuss or perhaps resolve some of our concerns, but when they came, their statement was they had no intention of changing anything no matter what we said. So after some discussion, we walked out. Our group has personally spent more hours than we can count, drove to meetings, rented halls to bring in a variety of experts on air quality, geology, and water resource experts to answer the questions of the citizens of Eota. That was on our dime. We gathered over 700 signatures of citizens over 18 years of age that stated they do not want this industry built in the proposed location. There's about 1,200 people in Eota, but most of them are not, and there's several that aren't voting in these. So all of the time and effort we have spent cost us personally a great deal of money. At the same time, we are paying for the MPCA staff to do the work for the investors of this refinery to the tune of $5,700, and at $150 an hour, that's almost $1 million. There seems to be no fairness in this process. The MPC and other agencies appear to have a total disconnect. One is permitting pollution with our tax dollars, and the other is cleaning it up with our tax dollars. This has to stop. These agencies need to work together towards the goal set by this state. The Rochester Public Utilities customers are paying $38 million to clean up Southeast Minnesota's air with an air emission project. Yet, the MPCA is willing to permit an ethanol refinery that will then be the largest polluter in Southeast Minnesota. Where has our common sense gone? What are they thinking? We have the right to clean air. We are paying for it. I just voted in support of an amendment in the last election that would allow more funds to protect hunting and fishing habitats, and yet this refinery, if built, will have a negative impact on our trout streams, wetlands, and drinking water. The DNR states there is no end to our supply of pristine drinking water, yet other states are fighting over water rights because they are running out. State agencies such as the MPCA need to take the blinders off. They need to look beyond the project they are working on and support the nation's effort to reduce our carbon footprint, have a sustainable water system, a clean water source, great trout streams for recreation, clean air for our children to breathe, and conserve energy. Their goal should be to bring the citizens into the process early, listen to the people most impacted, and not just promote a political agenda of a few, while ignoring the impact that this will have on the environment and quality of life for those that have lived, worked, paid taxes all their life, and have a nice home in this rural setting. I'm disgusted when I see how much time and money was spent to promote an industry in a location that it should not be in. This must stop. Money should not be able to buy the right to pollute. And we as taxpayers should not have to support a political agenda promoting ethanol that we do not believe in, and experts have proven that ethanol pollutes more than gasoline.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we are going to have to move a little more rapidly here because we're going to make sure that we have a fair distribution of time. So if you would want to move on to... And maybe no more than 5 more minutes.
Perhaps Paul had brought some of the more technical details, but maybe we do need to talk a little more about the process and the issues.
I think we want to concentrate on two issues here. The process of why... This was an EAW instead of an EIS because the reading of the statute says that an EAW is to be a brief document that tells us whether there is potential for significant environmental effects. The rules tell us it's to be a rapid assessment. So that's one issue, and I think Ms. Levin's talked a lot about the relationship between the PCA and the citizens, and that's the other big issue here. What is the process for working with citizens and an industry? So those are the two issues that I think that we need to concentrate on.
Very good, though. I found in my files here, and I'll submit this to the committee, a flowchart that was done by the Pollution Control Agency in September 7th of 07 that laid out a short process for the EAW. They concluded that it was first submitted on August of 07 and would be completed the middle of December in 07. So originally this was conceived of as a short process and a short review. And it became something much more than that.
I think that's a very important thing, and perhaps we can have the page send that document around.
The second thing I wanted to point out was a slide from a presentation that was given by Myrna Hallback of the Pollution Control Agency relative to the process of getting plants approved. And the significant thing here is what's in red, and it's the question marks about water. and the issue that we're raising of high volume water use for ethanol plants, 4 to 5 gallons per gallon of ethanol. This was one of the issues of concern that was listed in their own presentations and things that we raised that were kind of gone away. This is a map of my personal concern. This is out of the trout stream map of southeastern Minnesota. This is a multi-county map. Within the area that I've outlined, there are no wells as big as the well and the production that would be done by Minergy. There's no models that address this large volume of water supply getting to the issue of sustainability and significance of concern. What we encountered was what I call a stonewall process. They were driving the bus. They first didn't want to let us on. When we did get on, we had to sit at the back of the bus and receive the information through Freedom of Information Act or public meetings where they were simply not forthcoming, wouldn't allow questions in the first place, or would only answer questions about process, and did not get back to us with their levels of concern. We had developed over time a community of concern in the Yoda area, a community concerned about their water supply, concerned about the impact of air emissions, concerned about compatibility and land use issues, and had to rely on experts that simply didn't even catch the errors in the report. So we had a breach of confidence that occurred in the middle of this process that became even more adversarial. And we found that rather than being an advocate for the environment and an advocate for citizens that had these concerns, that they were simply an advocate and promoter of an applicant that wanted to build an ethanol plant. An awful lot of time and effort was spent on behalf of the agency defending this advocacy. So what do we need to do is the question, I think. And there are a number of things. We have records that they've spent over 5,700 hours of time dealing with the EAW and permit process. That's 3 full-time equivalents in a state agency that is under budget pressure. Unrecovered costs. If this had truly been an EAW process, this would have been a short form, 30 pages, there's these issues. You guys go back and study this, come back with the answers in this public forum where we have public scoping opportunities and a public review of a draft document and a public review of a final document. And if we had stuck to that process, the time would have been limited to 280 days by statute. It would have been done well within the time that it took them to keep the citizens out of the process over a 2-year period of time. It was pretty simple, that, in our view, that this should have been an EIS. It amazes me to this day that Minergy did not agree to an EIS. If they had volunteered to do this work, it would have started the process, we would have had the information, been involved in it, and they would have been done a year earlier than the conclusion we have now. But they were all trying to answer these questions. At the end of the process, when we issued our final report and questions that needed to be resolved, we asked the Pollution Control Agency whether the applicant was going to answer the question. They said, no, this is our responsibility. We're going to do the science to answer your question, not the applicant. And they had no means to recover the cost. If you're not aware, the billing rate for people that use the MPCA services is $155 an hour. At $5,700, this is almost $900,000 worth of benefit that I've paid for as a taxpayer for them to review documents, not answer the questions, not find the errors, and to say everything's okay. What we need in this instance, I think, is a rule or statute that says it's okay for the state to pay for the process. That should be 100 hours or 150 hours, and the state has an obligation to do that to protect us. What we need is a plan of water sustainability that would answer these questions before it even gets to an application stage. If we could understand what is really sustainable in our water supply in this area, we would have a better shot of making these in the right place at the right time with the resources. What we need is to concentrate on the TMDL process. We have a conflict here where the PCA is saying, do this that won't have an impact or cure it when it happens. What we need is to stop the bus from rolling over the citizens.
With that, I think we are going to have to, if you'd like to make a very short comment, because I am trying to be as fair as possible in dividing the time up here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make one really quick comment concerning the local support for an EIS. The City of Yoda had an ethanol advisory council. They submitted a letter during the EAW comment period to request an EIS. The City Council of Yoda also submitted a letter during the EAW comment period requesting an EIS. The Whitewater Joint Powers Board submitted a similar letter. The Olmsted County Environmental Commission also submitted a letter requesting an EIS after having reviewed this project, as well as the Olmsted County Board. So there was wide grassroots support for requiring an EIS on this project. And again, we really feel as though the MPCA did not listen to those concerns. And the question that I will just simply pose is one that our president posed in his inaugural address. He simply said, the question today we ask is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're just going to have one question here because I am watching the clock. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just curious, was there a CBI claim on that confidentiality? For the confidential business information? I mean, what was the rationale there? I don't get it.
Madam Chair and members, it turned out that at the time this confidentiality claim was signed, there were competing interests that wanted to build ethanol plants in the area, and they were concerned about disclosing locations and financial information. So they asked the city council members not to talk to anybody about that. The city council, once we pointed this out, quickly realized their mistake and apologized to us. But so they resolved the issue once we raised.
Madam Chair, it didn't fit CBI. That's what I. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for testifying. I trust you'll be here for other questions.
Thank you. We'd be happy to answer any other questions.
All right. And now we'd like to have the Pollution Control Agency come down. And Jeff Richards is going to be talking with us. And I think we want to make sure that we are sticking to these two big questions of why there really was no brief EAW and that just why that didn't happen, and the relationship with the community. And that there then have two questions have been raised that I think are go along with this. And one was, who is really responsible for doing the science, number one? And number two, who is responsible for paying for all this work? Mr. Broberg put on the table that this probably cost the agency $900,000. I think that's what I heard. And if you could help us out with that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I will. And if I somehow fail to answer those two questions in the course of this, please bring them up again, and I will for sure answer those for you. My name is Jess Richards. I'm the manager of the biofuel sector for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And there were a couple handouts today for you. You have the slide. You also have a report on the hours per the staff people that worked on this project for our time tracking report. And then there is also a breakdown of the cost per staff person for the preparation of the EAW. So that is this worksheet right here. So that's basically taking the staff salaries and their rate of pay times the hours that they put into it. And the grand total on the bottom for staff hours for the EAW is $245,000 if you look at that. And we can refer back to these documents as we go along. If you see
and at what rate per hour were you putting charging this?
These specific rates are based on the specific staff salaries for each person.
Which would be a range then?
Well, I can get into that, but you'll see later I'll talk about how we bill out for EIS work, which is $75 an hour.
Okay, so if this had been an EIS, it would have been billed at $75 an hour.
That's correct.
Okay. Getting a few facts on the table here.
Yep, absolutely. And of course, stop me anytime if you need some clarification. Okay, what I was asked to talk to you about today really is two key areas. Just a general overview of environmental review. I won't go into it in depth because you've already heard some of the law behind it, but I'll show you how it plays out with the MPCA with respect to having a citizens board and things like that. And I'll also talk to you a little bit more about the Minergy project and how that process unfolds. And with both sections, I will talk about time and hours that we spend on projects, for example, and the cost associated with those projects. One thing I need to state up front is that it's important for the committee to know that right now the Minergy project is under a lawsuit regarding the decision on the need for an EIS. And so, with respect to details about the science, which I appreciate, Madam Chair, that you don't want to go into that, and some of the details on the process, there are things I simply can't discuss due to the lawsuit. So I apologize in advance if I'm not able to answer all of your questions. Another thing I'd just like to state also, too, given the testimony earlier, is that I think it's important for the committee to remember that the staff that worked on this project from the MPCA, they're all staff that have been with the agency for a long time. They come to the agency and work for the agency because they care about the environment and they want to protect it. And they want to do a good job. And so while there may have been some professional disagreement with citizens on this project, it doesn't mean that the MPCA wasn't looking out for the environment. Okay, so briefly I'll start with environmental review. And as you heard, the environmental review process kind of breaks down into two key areas. The environmental assessment worksheet, often referred to as an EAW, and the environmental impact statement, often referred to as an EIS. The environmental assessment worksheet, both of these areas have mandatory thresholds which trigger the preparation of one of these documents. For example, in ethanol, the mandatory threshold for an EAW is a facility that is 5 million gallons or more, or an expansion of 5 million gallons or more for production. For an EIS, the trigger for an EIS in ethanol is a new facility of 125 million gallons per year, or an expansion of 125 million gallons. You heard about what these worksheets and these processes are designed to do. EAW, the purpose of the EAW is to determine whether there's a potential for significant environmental effects that are reasonably expected to occur. The difference with an EIS is that an EIS not only looks at environmental effects, it also looks at things like alternatives to the project, social and economic issues, and things like that that go a little bit beyond the normal environmental assessment. The decision process for an EIS is on the adequacy of an EIS. So what I mean by that is, once an EIS is prepared, the board's job is to determine whether that EIS adequately assessed the potential for significant environmental effects. And I'll get into that a little bit more as I go through the details of this.
Excuse me, we are going to take questions. Representative
Could you just briefly tell me what the threshold is based on there as far as the EAS, EAW, your 125 million gallons and based on emissions, do you know what emission, you know what that is?
Madam Chair, committee members, these were thresholds that were set up in the UCB rules and through the process of developing those rules. I'm not familiar with why they chose the specific levels.
Be good to know that.
I think perhaps going back and looking at the statute would be helpful at this point, because there is a mandatory EIS, but the general statute says when there is potential for significant environmental effects. That's the trigger, the general overall trigger. And so the question here, what did they see these general potential for significant environmental effects and put that out for the public to see to determine then whether to go into an EIS. So that's why we put the statute in your folder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this will become clearer as we go through the presentation too, and you can see kind of how it all fits together. The next slide here is a schematic of the environmental assessment worksheet process. As you can see, there are four triggers for the starting of an environmental assessment worksheet. One of them is the mandatory levels that we discussed. The second is if the responsible governmental unit, in this case the Pollution Control Agency, orders a discretionary EAW. The third is based on citizen petition. And the fourth is just simply if a project proposer volunteers to do one, which happens once in a while. I mentioned the word responsible governmental unit. This is a term that's used in environmental review process to designate the agency that's responsible for preparing the environmental assessment worksheet. The MPCA is, in the case of ethanol, is the responsible governmental unit. However, there are numerous other state agencies and governments that could be responsible governmental units depending on the type of project. Mining projects, for example, the DNR is the responsible governmental unit, and there's other projects in which the county would be the responsible governmental unit. So once that process is triggered, the agency receives a project proposal from the project proposer and does our review of their submittals. So basically, they provide the science, they provide the information, and we review it to ensure that it's accurate and complete. And once we've finished that and we've prepared an EAW, we place it on public notice for 30 days. The environmental review rules then also give the agency the option of having a public informational meeting. It's not required, but it is something we do if there's a lot of public interest. And then ultimately, after we've taken public comments, reviewed thoroughly those comments, taken another look at the EAW to see if it addresses the comments, and we'll prepare a recommendation with respect to whether there's a potential for significant environmental effects. During the comment period, anyone asks for an EIS, then that decision on significant potential for environmental effects will go before our MPCA Citizen Board. If it does not occur, if there is no request for an EIS, then typically it's a decision that is made by our commissioner. So once that, let's just pretend that it goes to the board, we'll talk that way. If that's the case. And once it goes to our citizens board, then again takes public testimony, considers the testimony that was given by the public and considers all of the records and all of the facts and the staff recommendations, and ultimately makes a decision on whether there's a significant potential for environmental effects. If the answer is yes.
Excuse me. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just, I'm wondering where in this process, if you could, as you're discussing it, where the engagement with the other agencies, state agencies, comes in, and if you could just highlight as you move through the flow chart, like if you, particularly with this plant, it appears that you're in the karst area, you've got that rapid movement between surface water and groundwater, so Health Department, Department of Natural Resources, when do you engage them in the process, either informally or formally? And maybe you're going to get to that, but I'd like some description of that.
Madam Chair, committee members, I can actually just answer that for you right now. I don't have a specific slide on that. So the once that project application comes in to us as the RGU, one of the first things we do, for example, in the case of ethanol, is make sure that the Department of Natural Resources is engaged, so they can be looking at issues, for example, like parks or water appropriation. So we are engaging the the other agencies throughout the development of the EAW, and then also during the evaluation of citizen comments and the development of our recommendations. So it really is continual throughout the process.
Then is their time spent on it clocked? Do they have a cost code, and is that included in your sheet, or is this only the pollution control agency time?
Madam Chair, committee members, the costs that you'll see are just the pollution control agency. They do not include the other agencies. Okay. So, finishing up on the EAW, once a decision is made, if it does have a significant potential for environmental effect, then we'll move into an EIS. If not, then we're authorized to go forward with permitting. Just quickly, these are some of the key issues that are covered, for example, in ethanol in an EAW. Air emissions, we do air emission risk analysis. We do a look at wastewater and how it might work in conjunction with water standards or impaired waters. We look at water appropriations and aquifer and surface water interactions. These are just examples. There's a number of other things that are covered as well. So the next big piece of environmental review is the environmental impact statement. Now, as I mentioned, if there's a potential for significant environmental effect through an EAW, that would trigger the preparation of an EIS. Similarly, as I mentioned before, if there's a mandatory category, such as the 125 million gallon threshold, that would also trigger the preparation of an EIS. And the first step in that process is that the agency prepares the draft scoping document. And what we do then is we go out and we place that on public notice. We have a public informational meeting to take input on the scope of the project. And then we ultimately bring that decision to our MPCA Citizens Board. So after we take public comment, we develop we finalize the scoping document, bring it to our Citizens Board. They hear more public comment, and then they decide on the scope.
Okay. In this particular case, since we're trying to do a case study here,
mm-hmm.
when did you feel that you brought it, the scoping process to this, put the scoping document out to the citizens to see to say, well, are we ready to go or not for an EIS?
Madam Chair, committee members, there was not an EIS for this. So
I know,
therefore,
we're ready to get for an EIS. The scope of it, the scoping process for the EAW, I mean, the brief document setting out the basic facts. To determine whether an environmental impact statement is required. When did you do that? I mean, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. I will show you in a slide just a little bit down the row here exactly how the whole public process is laid out, if that's okay.
Okay. Yes, because we're trying to do a general...
I'll get through this.
Okay.
That's
all right.
What you're asking. Okay. So, if you look at the rest of the process, basically there's a preparation of a draft, another public informational meeting, another public comment period, again review of public comment, and then ultimately the decision for an EIS on whether it was adequate goes again before our Citizens Board for more public comment and a decision. Typically in an environmental review process, these are the public opportunities for input into the process. There's a 30-day public comment period in an EAW. There's an optional public meeting. And there's one citizens board meeting usually if there's a request for an EIS. In the EIS process, there's a 30-day comment period for scoping, a 30-day comment period for the draft, two public meetings, and two citizen board meetings. So just to get to cost in the general scheme of environmental review, this slide represents all of the EIS work that our agency has been involved with in fiscal years 2008 and 2009. And as you can see, the vast majority of these projects are mining projects in which the DNR is the responsible governmental unit. These costs associated with those mining projects are just the MPCA's costs for our work on those mining projects. The one example here, Xcel Energy Ash Landfill, is one where the MPCA was the RGU, and we prepared the EIS, and that you can see is the cost of around $400,000. It's important to note that the agency is, as you know, only allowed to charge for EISs and not for the preparation of an EAW document. But at the request of the chair, the agency did take a look at some of the costs associated with preparation of EAWs and staff time associated with EAWs. And here's a few examples of some projects that are ethanol projects. The Poet Glenville West project, about $39,000. The Agassiz project, about $112,000. And then the Minergy project, about $240,000 for the preparation of the EAW. These are all corn ethanol facilities. They range in complexity and level of public interest, from very little complexity or public interest on the Poet project to a lot more public interest on the Minergy project. And I'll get much more into the details of Minergy with cost with later on as well. And since one of the questions, Madam Chair, earlier, I think, was just the time frame of projects in general. And just to give you a framework here, the Xcel Energy EIS took approximately 30 months. The median time for an ethanol EAW is 8.25. And the median, if you cross all sectors, feedlots, mining, the whole work, is 4.5 months. There's a range within these now, anywhere from a couple months to, you know, up to 18, or in the case of Minergy, 15, depending on the specifics of the project. So let's talk Minergy. So I think that's what everybody wants to talk about. And Minergy, I think I won't go into a lot of detail, but it's located in Olmsted County. And if you take a look here on this map, it's about a half a mile from downtown of the city of Eota. And the Minergy project is the red hash. Their site is the red hash marked area. And the city boundaries are the yellow lines shown on this map. And just a summary of what the project was. It's a corn ethanol production facility fueled by natural gas into two phases. The first phase is 52 million gallons of production. The second phase is 75 million gallons of production. As you know, it required a mandatory environmental assessment worksheet. Other things such as a minor air emissions permit and a water discharge permit for things like their cooling water and industrial stormwater. So, now we'll get to process. And specifically, it's the Minergy process. I'll walk you through how this project unfolded. And every time you see a blue item on the screen, that is one of the public interaction pieces or one of those public meetings. We were first contacted by Minergy in September of 2006 saying, you know, we've got a project. Nothing formal, we've just got a project. And so we had a pre-application meeting where we tell them what we expect to see in a project. And then we participated in a meeting in Eota Township, at the request of Eota Township, where 200 people from the public attended so that we could describe what the environmental review process would look like for this project. At that meeting, we went through the process, and we also made it clear that we wanted to be available whenever folks needed us, and that we offered to come down to Eota or to Rochester anytime somebody wanted us to come down and talk to them. Now, you can see there's a big gap between that meeting and the time that we actually received complete and formal applications from the company. So we didn't receive the applications and the EAW project description until August of 2007. In November of 2007, we participated in another meeting that was hosted by Eota Township. About 100 people attended that meeting, and that was basically to take some comments, listen to concerns, and give an update on where we were in the review. And during the time then after that, we read the science, we listened to the science, we took a hard look at all the things that Minergy submitted, and then we developed the EAW for public notice. It was placed on public notice on June 2nd of 2008, and around the same time we placed the water permit on notice. And then, as Mr. Broberg described, we did extend the comment period to make sure there was a 60-day comment period rather than the normal 30 for this project on the EAW. We held our third public informational meeting in late June and discussed the EAW. This meeting involved a mix of formal presentation and formal open comments, you know, from the large group. And also, about half the time was spent with an open house format to have one-on-one conversations and have all of our staff that worked on this project available for one-on-one conversations with anybody that had specific details or specific questions. We placed the air permit on public notice in June of, or shortly after that, And we held another public meeting in the July of 08 as well. Again, we had an open house format. The notice that we published for that public meeting described that we would be starting the meeting with a short formal presentation and that we would be taking comments and then we would open it up to an open house. 60 people attended the first public meeting there in early June and about 40 attended the second one. And you can see then on August of 08, the comment periods for all the permits and EAW all closed, and that's when we began our review of the comments. There was extensive comments on this project, 182 comment letters, and so we took our time and reviewed them thoroughly and thought about how they interact with the EAW that we had drafted to see if there was any changes that needed to be made. So between August 1st and October, we spent a great deal of time looking at the comments and preparing a recommendation for our board and preparing the record for this project. In October of 2008, the first board meeting was held regarding this DAW for this project. It was a packed house, and there was a lot of people that wanted to comment. And at the end of the day, there was over 20 people that still hadn't had an opportunity to comment before our board. Our board then postponed the decision to November at the request of the Olmsted County Concerned Citizens Group. We came down to Rochester to talk about what we felt the board's conclusions were at that first board meeting and talk about what the next steps for the process were. And, you know, contrary to maybe what was testified earlier, the agency didn't come to any of these meetings with any preconceived notions or any preconceived agendas. We simply wanted to come and listen and share what we thought the decisions were of these board meetings. In November of 08, then, the board had a second meeting. Over 20 people signed up to testify. Meeting, again, was well attended. And at that time, the board made the decision that they felt that based on the testimony, the public comments, our review of those comments, and all of the facts and all of the data around this particular project, that there was not a significant potential for environmental effect. As such, then, we issued the air permit in December of 08. However, the board did ask to hear the water permit again. They wanted to listen to the water permit and listen to some more specific issues about that. And so we brought the water permit back to our citizens board in December 16th of 08. And at that time, the board agreed that the permit was protective and met standards and authorized the agency to issue the water permit, which we did in December of 08. And then, as you can see, the last thing on here is that we were served with a lawsuit in early January of this year, appealing the decision on the significant potential for environmental effects. So just a summary of the public opportunities here on this project specifically. There were four public meetings in EOTA. Were not are required. There was a 60-day comment period for the EAW, where 30 days is required. Both permits had extended comment periods beyond the 30 days that were required. We had one meeting with the Olmsted County Concerned Citizens Group. This was the only time we were taken up on our offer to come down and meet with the citizens beyond the formal public meeting. We had three citizen board meetings and numerous interactions via telephone, email, those types of things with the citizens as well. And just to take a look here at the cost for energy, the project total time was 15 months, Madam Chair. I think you had asked that earlier. The EAW took approximately 3,200 staff hours. Permitting took approximately 2,500 staff hours. And if you use our rate of, for a total of $5,700, if you use our rate that we charge for an EIS of $75 an hour, it's a consolidated rate of all staff rates, you reach a conclusion that the EAW cost approximately $240,000 in staff time, and the total was probably $430,000 in staff time if you add the permitting into that. And, you know, lastly, one important data piece that I don't have on here is that if you take a look at the hours spent after the EAW was published. So after we've completed all of our review of the project proposal, 3,700 hours of that 5,700 hours was spent after the EAW was published. That 3,700 hours that were spent on public processes, on preparing the record, on reviewing public comments and public testimony, on going to 3 board meetings and 2 additional public informational meetings. And so I understand that, you know, there probably is disagreement with folks on, professional disagreement on our conclusions. But I wanted to reflect really that these hours, the time we spent on the public information, reflects that we did listen and the public did have a voice in this process.
Representative Bell has a question. We're going to just take questions for about 5 minutes. We're going to have Chuck Dayton testify in a few minutes. So.
Just real brief, Mr. Richard. Thank you, Madam Chair. Were you the biofuels manager at PCA throughout this process?
Madam Chair, committee members, I became biofuels manager in January of 2008, and prior to that, it was Myrna Hallbeck.
Thank you.
One of the things that I observed just looking at this EAW is something I think that one of the board members, at the MPCA board members, observed, that this contained all of the information in an EIS. So that's why you didn't have to do an EIS. And when I look at the requirements or what's supposed to be done in an EIS, it's, and this members is in your packet, you're supposed to analyze significant environmental impacts, discuss appropriate alternatives, and explore methods by which adverse environmental impacts of an action would be mitigated. And I look at this document, and it seems to include most of that. Would you agree with that?
Madam Chair, committee members, this document contains all the science behind the environmental issues regarding this project so that we could make that determination on the potential for significant environmental effects. It doesn't include an alternatives analysis. It doesn't include social and economic analysis, which are all things that would be done in an EIS.
Does it analyze the significant environmental impacts?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes, it does.
And that's part of an EIS.
Madam Chair, committee members, both an EAW and an EIS look at environmental impacts. And the EAW's threshold is to look at the proposed project to see if there's significant potential for environmental impacts. Whereas an EIS, basically you have significant potential for environmental impacts, and then the EIS looks at how do you mitigate those, how do you, what other considerations or alternatives do you have to that project. Sometimes it's a no-build alternative. Sometimes it's simply a change in the project design.
I'm looking back at the statute, and an EAW is supposed to be a brief document, supposed to be rapidly done, and determine whether an EIS is required. And in EIS, you're supposed to analyze the significant environmental impacts. And it seems to me we shifted here, going from an EAW into an EIS. Perhaps only a partial EIS from your point of view, but there was we've morphed one into another. That is an observation that I make as I look at this. Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Doty.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It appears from this that one of the reasons, that the main reason that slowed down the process of the main citizen questions around interaction between groundwater and this project, do you feel that you have adequate science, enough test wells and so on, to so that the answers that you're giving are real answers to these folks?
Madam Chair, committee members, the actual groundwater appropriation process is handled by the Department of Natural Resources. As you may be aware, there was also a study done by the Environmental Quality Board at the request of the Pollution Control Agency on water sustainability as a whole. And that study does take a look at, for the long term, what data needs are needed and what new monitoring and things are needed to continually improve our understanding of groundwater. That said, the process at the DNR does take a very site-specific look, and it takes a look at the other users in the area, and it is a thorough process that, and I believe, did adequately assess the water needs and the water availability for this project.
Let me follow up on Representative Doty's question. Was a good one. DNR says it only has responsibility for looking at the quantity of water. You have the issue of looking at the quality of the water, whether it's going to be polluted or not from this process. Did you feel like you had sufficient test wells and all of what he said to make the determination on quality?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, committee members. Well, I can't get into the details really on the science, and I hope you understand with the lawsuit. We had a specific person that was assigned to look closely at the water quality issues, and the conclusions of the EAW that you'll see in the record is that there wasn't a potential significant environmental effect from those issues.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Madam Chair, mine's a pretty simple one. Mr. Richards, the number, the $245,000, right, that was the total. Is that included? Is that just the direct labor costs that they get on their paycheck, or is that include all the labor burden associated with the state's cost?
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm sorry I looked over to our fiscal director, Myrna Halbeck. It just includes the labor costs directly, I believe, for salaries for those specific individuals. It doesn't equate out to other issues.
We'll have one last question, Representative
Hanson. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for I had to leave for a moment, but are you saying that in your testimony that public participation has a cost and that drove up some of the costs involved in this and responding to public concern, and that when there's more controversy, you have more costs? Is that kind of the bottom line?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes. Certainly, when a project is more controversial, it requires more agency staff time to review that, to listen, to review all those comments, and to make sure that they are adequately heard. And certainly, I think in this case, there was a great deal of staff time and cost spent on public participation.
Representative.
And then a quick follow-up. So with the existing EAW and EIS process, so that would you say, in your experience, then, that the existing myriad of process encourages controversy, or does it deflate controversy? And not just on this issue, but across the board, these processes that we've set up, do they enhance controversy and then therefore enhance costs?
Madam Chair, committee members, I wouldn't necessarily say that the process encourages or discourages controversy. I would say that a specific project might be controversial, and there's a wide range of projects. Some projects, as a poet project as an example, practically no public comment or no interest at all. Other projects like Minergy, substantial public interest, and so I don't know that it's the process that encourages it as much as the location and the site.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Representative Lilly, you were on the list and I just missed that. Do you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine's kind of close to Representative Hanson's. I'm looking at this. You gave us like three pages of names here, and you know, mentioned about 3,700 hours or something was on the customer side of things, and it looks like there's only, when I kind of look at it, it looks like Adams, McGee Hill, and Summers were kind of the actual only people doing work out in the field. Is that a fairly accurate assessment?
Madam Chair, committee members, those particular individuals did do a lot of work on the project. Steve Summer was the project lead for the environmental review, so he will have the most hours on this project. Byron Adams was the hydrologist assigned to look at water quality and karst issues, so he certainly had a lot of hours on the project. The 3,700 hours that I mentioned includes permitting, and so it includes the public work that was also done for permitting, and those hours are spread throughout many people on this list.
Madam Chair, I mean, just in quick overview, it looks like I'm guessing environmental review would be hands-on, perhaps, and then, but it looks like there's about 40 people that are doing the customer relations kind of side of thing, and then, you know, 3 to 5 people doing actual research. So is that fairly typical?
Madam Chair, committee members, I'd have to take a close look at who did what. Some of the folks with lower hours are really technical staff that may have done water standards review, for example. Others are staff that help prepare presentations for the public meetings and things like that. So others are an air engineer writing the air permit and participating in the EAW for air. So I'm not sure if 42 is the number or how exactly that plays out, but all those people touched the EAW, I'm sure, at one point or another.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Mr. Dayton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this makes me feel pretty old. 35 years ago, I was a lobbyist for environmental groups and then a member of the first EQB that adopted the rules that you're talking about today. I think the only person here that might have been involved in that is Ron Way, who was a staffer for Wendy Anderson at that point. The rules on paper and the rules in practice are much different, as your questions have pointed out. It was never intended that an EAW be an extensive document like this. It was intended to be a checklist to determine whether or not there was a significant environmental effect. But we were terribly naive in thinking that a governmental unit, on the basis of an EAW, would order a discretionary EIS when it wasn't required by the mandatory category. They never, ever do it. Tell me one that's ever been done. Maybe one. Maybe the University of Minnesota Steam Plant. But we get about 6 or 8 EISs a year and 130 EAWs. So why do we have these monster EAWs when it would be just as easy to do an EIS? Well, one legitimate reason might be that the proposer wants to make a record so that the true facts are before the decision-making body. That's a good reason. But other reasons might be, well, if I do an extensive EAW, I can avoid doing an EIS. Why would I care? Well, one is the costs don't get passed on to me. And the other is that I don't have to look at alternatives. If I'm a proposer, do I want to examine alternatives that are going to give my opponents ammunition to say, don't do it that way, here's a better way to do it? So there's a natural inclination on the part of a proposer not to want to do an EIS. Massachusetts does a couple hundred EISs a year. And probably we spend about the same amount of money doing EAWs that we would do if we were to do EIS is in the same. And this EIODA plant is a great example of a case where they should have done an EIS would be appropriate. Here's karst topography. The groundwater goes every place. And that should be required to do an EIS, and what are the alternatives? How can we prevent that? Perfect example. The process has been perverted. It's been that way for 20 years. John Herman and I wrote an article for Prevention Bar 20 years ago, complaining about the same thing. It hasn't changed. That's the problem. The other problem with the process involving citizen input that we have been complaining about is that when they notice the draft EAW for public comment, they also notice the permit. And so when the comment period expires, the comment period on the permit expires, and the next day they issue the permit. That's a slap in the face to anybody who files a comment on the draft EAW, because how are they going to consider the comments from the draft EAW if they issue the permit the day that the comment period closes? So I'd be happy to answer your questions, but I know time is short.
Well, if there are questions from members, the observation that if there is no EIS but there is just an EAW, that really means the taxpayer is paying rather
than the proposer. And I think that has become more and more clear as we've looked at it. And of course, Representative McNamara asked another perfect question about, is the proposer even paying all of the costs?
May I respond briefly,
yes.
Madam Chair? In some counties and cities, there are ordinances which have passed, I understand, have passed some of those costs of EAW work onto the proposer. Also, the rule provides that the proposer provides the technical information for the EAW. What it doesn't do is to pay for the staff time necessary to review the EAW, but the technical information for a local unit of government, for example, comes from the consultant that's hired by the proposer. So not all the costs are borne by the local or the unit of government in the case of an EAW. Some of them are borne by the proposer.
One of the, I think, under the fundamental issue here is the role of the PCA, I think, is to be the honest broker. Do you feel that is it the honest broker? So let me put it differently. Is it the honest broker, or are they the ones that are supposed to protect our natural resources? Because I'm sensing we've moved more to the broker than the protector. Could I be right about that?
Nothing ever changes. agencies, the proposer will come to the agency months in advance of submitting the application and talk with the staff and develop a relationship with the staff. It's just the way it's done. They get to know the people, they get to know the project, and the opponents come in after it's out in the public, and they're the bad guys who are trying to kill the project. So there's a human tendency to, you know, connect with the people that are applying for the permit. It's not evil, it's just the way things happen. So, you know, I don't want to cast stones, it's just sort of the nature of the process.
Are there any other questions? I appreciate your perspective, and thank you for doing this. Does anybody else in the audience want to testify or make a comment? I don't see anyone else. Representative Giselle, we have the minutes of February 9th. Would you be so kind as to move them? Representative Giselle has moved the minutes of February 10th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are adopted. The meeting is adjourned.